from WXXI News. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made on October 6th at the Hall of Justice in Rochester, where a jury had reached an impasse. They were considering the case of Charlie Tan, accused of second-degree murder, the case going back to early February when Charlie's father Jim was found shot to death. The jury had begun deliberations on September 29th, but a week later, they had come to no consensus. They had requested multiple rereadings of testimony. They had piled up hours of discussion and deliberation, but there appeared to be no way out of the deadlock. But that was not the end. Not a hung jury, not a mistrial yet. The judge directed the jury to keep going, to try to come to a conclusion. His note to the jury read in part, quote, "Start with a fresh slate. Do not feel bound by how you felt before, whether you favored conviction or acquittal. Have the courage to be flexible. Be willing to change your position if a reevaluation of the evidence convinces you that a change is appropriate." And the judge continued, quote, "I urge that each of you make every possible effort to arrive at a just verdict here. Please make every effort consistent with your conscience and the evidence in this case to harmonize your views and decisions in this case with those of the other jurors," end quote. The jury was 8-4 in favor of conviction and did not change that composition, but it had observers wondering, what if it had been 11-1? Is it appropriate for a judge to instruct a jury to keep going, even when they feel exhausted or stressed? Does that pressure those in the minority to change their minds? Ultimately, the judge declared a mistrial 2 days later, after 50 hours of deliberations over 8 days and no conclusion. This hour, we welcome one of the jurors in that trial, and we're looking at the broader question of expectations for juries, how to make sure juries don't feel overcome with stress. It's not an easy situation. And let me welcome my guests for the hour. They include Sandra Dorley, Monroe County District Attorney. Great to have you here.
Great to be here. Thank you.
Jennifer McGough was one of the jurors in the Tan trial and very generous with your time. Thanks for being here, Jennifer.
Thank you.
Gary Craig's a reporter with the Democrat and Chronicle. Nice to see you, Gary.
Good to see you, Evan. Thanks.
Mark Foti is the chair of the Monroe County Bar Association Criminal Justice Section and a former public defender. Mark, nice to see you as well.
Thanks for having me, Evan.
District Attorney Dorley, let's start with you just because I want to make sure that our audience understands with a mistrial in this case, there's a lot to come here and there are limitations on what you can and can't say. Fair?
Exactly. Evan, the case is still pending in court, and it's back in court on November 5th. So, you know what? I'm excited to be here and to talk about jury selection and jury service in general. But I'm going to avoid the Tan trial if you don't mind.
No, I understand.
Thanks.
I completely understand. Though I also know that no matter what happens in a trial, you have always said that you respect the work of the juries because it is not easy.
Absolutely, and especially this jury. I do want to commend them for 50 hours of deliberation over 8 days after sitting through the trial. You know. Thank you for your citizenry.
All right. Well, let's turn to Jennifer McGough, who was one of the jurors in the Tan trial. First of all, are you disappointed that the jury did not reach a unanimous conclusion here?
I think I was at first. Now I've come to terms with it, and I don't know that more time would have mattered. So I think that stopping it then was actually fine. There were, at the end, a couple people, I think, that were just had their heels in the sand and they weren't going to budge no matter what we decided or what tactic we took to try and come to a conclusion. So I'm fine with it now.
Did it feel contentious?
Absolutely. At times. Not all the time.
Okay. So I suppose like any situation where there's difficult deliberations that end up going dozens of hours, there are going to be contentious moments, but when the judge comes to you and says, I want you to keep going here, at that moment, did that make sense to you? Did you think, well, okay, I'm glad we've got more time here, even though it feels like we're at an impasse?
Well, when we had sent the note out saying that we were at an impasse, it was, I think a lot of people thought we were done. I thought we were done. I didn't know about this Allen charge thing. Somebody brought it up while we were waiting for the judge to respond to the note that the judge can tell us to go back in and keep working, but I didn't think he would do that because it had already been 6 days, and I figured it's been 6 days. We haven't reached a verdict at this point. But after he sent us back in, we did exactly what he had instructed us to do, which was to clear our minds, come in with new motivation to mm-hmm. try and reach a consensus, which I think we all really did a good job of trying to do that.
It's got to be hard to do at that point,
it's
right?
Really hard because I had seen a definite, I could connect the one point to the next to have reached the conclusion that I had reached already. So it's hard to forget those things. It's hard to forget that I saw that connection. But we worked as hard as we could. And at one point, we decided to have a debate. So the day he instructed us to go back in and keep trying, we came up with the idea to have a debate where the people who were on the guilty side would have to argue for acquittal, and the people on the not guilty side would have to argue for conviction. And we were going to do the debate the next day. So we had the people that were fence sitters who were undecided at that point or couldn't reach a conclusion at that point come up with debate questions. And then we actually executed that the next day. And I thought that was really cool because I had to think like the other side. And even though I did think like the other side outwardly and come up with some good arguments, I thought, for acquittal, I still felt like I would convict if the vote was being taken that day.
So in other words, it didn't change your position, but you do feel like you really did get inside the idea
right.
of what would it take and what is that argument. And that helped you.
Right. It totally did help me because the day prior to that, I felt like I don't understand why these people think he's not guilty. I don't understand. I don't see the doubt at all, like the reasonable doubt. I don't see it. And it occurred to me that then I didn't have to understand each individual doubt that they had because we had them listed on a board. I just had to understand that there was doubt. And for those people, that was a reasonable doubt. And it's such a hard thing. It's not a tangible thing. It's not defined. It's like what you think is reasonable. I did not find that the doubts were reasonable, but that was me personally. Others did. So how do you figure that out?
Talking to Jennifer McGough, who was one of the jurors in the recent Tan trial. And on the outside, and you know, you're sort of in this insular world on a jury, which mm-hmm. which has got to be difficult, especially with the community talking about this kind of a trial. On the outside, you heard some people, some observers were saying, well, hey, Jim Tan looked like the kind of guy who was abusive, and we may not know exactly who did it, but isn't it a just result? I mean, some people were very harsh about that. When you're inside that jury room, are you thinking, I'm setting aside how I feel about Jim Tan and his actions, and I'm simply assessing who did this?
Yes, actually, we had to do that, and that's why since I'm no longer on the jury now and it was a mistrial, I've heard about there's like all these phone calls for domestic violence from the Tan home that did not get introduced mm-hmm. into evidence. That doesn't change my mind at all because even though Jim Tan wasn't an upstanding human being that treated people well, like you're kind of sending a message that you can kill people like that and it's okay, even if they're not coming at you in that moment, in the heat of the moment.
Okay. Now,
and I don't think that's okay.
Now, understanding an Allen charge now, and by the way, Gary Craig from the Democrat and Chronicle, over the years, how many times can you recall Allen charges?
I mean, I've seen multiple trials where there's been at least one, as we're talking about earlier. Sometimes you get two, but that's probably about the limit you're going to see.
Mark, how many have you seen?
This would probably be the second that I've seen in the most recent years. It obviously does happen, but for the most part, the jury goes in there with a job to do, and they try to accomplish that job if possible.
Sure, and so District Attorney Dorley, it's certainly not unheard of, but how would you define it for our listeners who are still unclear what an Allen charge is?
You know, it's an instruction to the jury from the judge, and it's basically asking them to go in and give it another chance, maybe start from scratch, reexamine your beliefs and your review of the evidence. But you know what? It's not uncommon for judges to give Allen charges. You know, I'm trying to think of, if I had to tell you how many of the trials that I've done over my career, almost 24 years, you know, there have been numerous times where Allen charges have been given. And, you know, oftentimes the jury does go back, reevaluate the evidence, begin deliberations anew, and render a verdict. So it doesn't always necessarily end in a hung jury.
Now, let me just speak very, very generally here, not about the Tan trial, but as my observer and as having never served on a jury. And by the way, I regret that. I know a lot of people say, "What hires how to get out of jury duty?" I want to be on a jury. I find it fascinating. I find it an important service.
Me too.
And Jennifer, you're nodding with it. I mean, I know, and we're going to talk about stress in a moment. Regardless of the stress, people like Jennifer McGough are doing very important work for our community. So I'd love to do it. I wouldn't want to get out of it. My concern would be, what if I'm the one and it's 11-1 and the judge is saying, "Don't give up"? Am I going to start to feel undue pressure, District Attorney Dorley?
You know, you could. And that's one thing that, you know, the judge's instructions do emphasize. We don't want you just to change your vote to end jury service and walk out for the weekend. But we want people to, if you're in that 11-1 situation, to keep an open mind and maybe give it another, you know, full and fair evaluation in your head and go over the facts. The last thing that anyone in the system wants is for someone to render a verdict or decide one way or the other when it's not their belief in their heart. Because the jury service, the jury system really works. We all believe in it. I think everyone in this room believes in it.
Okay. Mark Foti, is there a concern in your mind about that?
Absolutely. It's actually something that a number of states have looked at. The Allen charge dates back to 1896. It's been around for quite a long time, and it was a decision that came from the United States Supreme Court. So it certainly was applicable on a federal level, but the individual states have looked at it and assessed their own opinion. And I believe it's over 20 states have come to the conclusion that more so than asking the jury to go back and reevaluate, you're really trying to make them run a mental marathon, and you run the risk of one or two jurors potentially just becoming exhausted mentally, and at that point sort of conceding to the group because they feel there's no end in sight and it's inevitable at some point.
Now, isn't the other argument, though, Mark, that the system has invested a lot of energy, a lot of resources, frankly, a lot of money, and a lot of good faith work, and that human beings are human beings, and even if it's 11-1, that person who's won might not move, or they might say, you know, I want to listen more. Why am I the only holdout here? Maybe there is something I'm missing. And doesn't that give them that last chance to do that before you have to start over?
Yeah, I think that's the balancing tests that have been considered when determining whether an Allen charge is appropriate. In New York, there is a specific charge that's been drafted by a committee of attorneys, judges, and it's been said by the appellate courts you really can't deviate from that charge because they want to limit it to the idea that you're going back and giving it another read through, another an evaluation, and not trying to get the jury to come to the point where they're just conceding their personal opinion. So I think the idea is, considering all the things that you just talked about, it's appropriate to get them to possibly reevaluate, but trying to lay it out in a way that frames it so they don't go back and just give up if they're in the minority.
Okay, and District Attorney Dorley, we already have an email question from a listener named Alex who just wanted to know, does the judge know where the jury stands in that process at that point?
Absolutely not.
Of course not.
All they know from the note is that they've reached an impasse.
Okay.
Yeah.
And I wonder if Alex's question indicates that the judge should know. Of course the judge can't know.
Right.
And it seems to me that you've dealt with Allen charges. In general, generally speaking, that this kind of – I read part of the judge's note. It's a much longer note than what I read. That you're comfortable with the concept of the Allen charge as long as it's done in a way that says, we're not here to gang up on you, but got to start fresh and try to get this done?
Exactly. As Mark Foti said, you know what, we don't want any juror to vote against their conscience, but we want them to open their mind and perhaps, you know, give a second look. We don't ever want there to be a coercive verdict because that doesn't serve anyone.
Okay. Now, Jennifer, in the case of the jury and the Tan jury, and again, Jennifer was a Tan juror, it was, the final count was 8-4, is that right?
It was 8 who could definitely say guilty that day if we took a vote. There were 3 for not guilty, and there was 1 who was kind of going back and forth.
Okay. Were you concerned at all, even when you're in the majority, and you're thinking, you know, I really believe this, I've invested all this work, I'd like to work with the other jurors, you know, and essentially, you know, you're trying to make a case at that point to them mm-hmm. in deliberations, but are you also concerned at this point that someone's going to feel undue pressure?
I was worried about that a little bit, but there was a point in time after the Allen charge was read where it wasn't the day after that, the day we deliberated for 12 hours, everybody was engaged on that day. But the following day, the people who had been in the minority now going on 4 or 5 days just shut down. They did not want to engage in any more discussion. One was reading a book, one was doing Sudoku, one was like laying her head on the table trying to take a nap. Like body language, even though they said they were listening, body language indicated that they were done.
They were checked out of it.
They had checked out of it. There was nothing at that point anybody could say, I think that would have changed their mind. And that's how it was. So.
Okay. And so now you've got a mistrial and we're gonna do it all over again. And what is the biggest takeaway that you learned going into this process? You know, for most of our listening audience, most of us have not served on a jury and certainly not one of this length and intensity. Mm-hmm. What's the biggest takeaway that you had?
I thought it was fascinating. I thought it would be fascinating going into it regardless of what case I got. I've never tried to necessarily get out of jury duty, but that was an overwhelming thought that was when I was waiting to be called into the jury room for selection. Everybody was like, oh, what are you going to say to get out of jury duty? And I was like, nothing. I'm going to tell them that they're going to ask me certain questions. I'm going to answer them truthfully. And then if I'm picked, I'm picked. And that's what I would recommend everybody goes into that experience thinking, because you want a jury to have a variety of people from all walks of life. And that's how it works. And you can't have people who are maybe busy professionals like myself be like, I can't do this. I'm too busy for this. Like, that's just not a fair system. That's not how it should work. It should be a variety of people from all walks of life. So, and, you know, there are systems in place for people that are salaried like myself where, like, you don't really lose out on pay. I do have stuff that I have to do at work, but this is work too, which is a different thing, and it's for the greater good of the community. So you should just do it if you're called to do it and not just try to get out of it.
I wonder if Sandra and Mark are giving a thumbs up to that.
I'm definitely giving a thumbs up. I agree.
Mark?
Yeah, absolutely. I think she came in with the right attitude. And when you're selecting a jury, you're really looking for honest answers. Most of the lawyers say that right off the bat. There's no right answers or wrong answers, just the honest ones. And even if that means you get an answer you weren't looking for in jury selection, you'd rather have that come out at the time that you're asking the jurors voir dire on questions to determine who's the best. And if you have jurors who are interested in really being honest and serving, if appropriate, then you're going to end up with a good jury.
Now, for the concern that Jennifer raised, again, as someone on salary, it's less of a concern. But District Attorney Dorley, for the audience who's going to have to consider jury duty in the future and are thinking of creative ways to get out of it, does the system do enough to make sure that people can feel comfortable that if I miss work, if I miss certain obligations, that, you know, we'll be able to handle it?
You know what? The system tries, but the system's not perfect. You know, we deal with not only, you know, jurors in a trial setting, but we deal every week with grand jurors in a grand jury setting. And you know what? I always give them parking. You know, we've got people coming from all over the county, and they're coming down into the city of Rochester. Some don't ever come down into the city. At least, you know, have a parking lot for jurors so they know they can pull in. They know how to get into the courthouse and maybe get more acclimated and be more comfortable. But it's a tough thing. And Chuck Perot is doing a great job as the commissioner of jurors. And I have to say that over the last years, I've seen more diverse jury pools in both trial juries and grand juries. And in my experience, the most diverse juries are the most cohesive jurors.
Interesting. Now, former public defender Mark Foti, are you comfortable with that the system's doing enough for potential jurors to make sure they're comfortable with what they might be missing?
I think there's always the opportunity to look and see what more can be done. For the most part, I think the system is working. However, there are specific issues that can be identified. And it's really not my concern personally as to how these things are worked out. But one thing I know that's come up is jurors end up standing in the same line as everybody else as they're waiting to get in the courtroom. They're told to come earlier. There are some cases, and maybe it happened in this case, where they get specific passes so they can get through the line. But that only happens on a very select few cases, and it's typically the most high-profile cases. So you have people serving maybe on city court on a misdemeanor level or on a lower-profile case in county court, and they don't receive some of these same benefits. So I certainly think that an effort could be made to extend those to jurors who are serving just as important of a duty in cases that aren't as high-profile. But specifically, it doesn't come into play in terms of any relief we're seeking from the court as attorneys ourselves.
Okay. Now, Jennifer, did you hear from your fellow jurors at any point, we've got to get this done, I've got to get back to my life?
We all, I think, said that at one point or another, but we didn't mean it in the way that, like, let's
compromise
just
whatever
make
we think
a decision.
Just to make a decision. Right, right.
Doesn't matter what it is, just because I got to get back to work. There was a girl on the jury who had finished one job and was about to begin another job when she got called for jury duty. And so they told her, her new job said, just don't start until you're done with your jury duty. So she was getting no pay at all for the whole 3 weeks that we were getting, you know, on jury duty. And then the $40 a day that you get if you're not being paid by your employer, you have to, like, apply for at the end of your time served, and then it takes 4 to 6 weeks to issue a check. So She was luckily in a situation where she was living with somebody who could pay her bills for her temporarily. So that was a hardship for her. And she really wasn't one that was pushing to be done. So others were over the whole situation. And but even though I say that, I mean, nobody was rushing to get to a verdict, just any verdict. We all still wanted it to be the right verdict. We all agreed that the worst thing we could do was come up to a verdict that was wrong.
Email from Len says, didn't I read in the Democrat and Chronicle that the judge threatened to hold them overnight? You can't hold jurors hostage. Then they will start compromising their values. Gary Craig.
I don't believe that's the case. I mean, he did, as the case went on, obviously, decide to keep them later into the evening. I don't think I ever heard anything about sequestration, you know, basically keeping them at a hotel or whatever. But I don't think that was ever part of the conversation.
Okay.
No, it wasn't. No, we stayed until 9 or 9:30 one night.
But you never felt like it was inappropriately long and pressuring?
I didn't, but I have the type of personality where I'm going to do what I have to do until it's done.
I think Mark and Sandra are going to clone you
for future juries.
Yeah. Chuck Perot wants to also.
Say, you may volunteer for jury service.
There were a few of us that had a very good work ethic that mm-hmm. would just keep going and keep going and keep going. And I'm used to where I work now. I work 12 to 13-hour shifts. So 12 or 13 hours, it's a different kind of work. You're in one room. You can't leave for lunch and all that other stuff, which is – there's no windows. Like, it is a little bit confining. But I didn't ever feel like – I mean, I was stuck there, but I didn't feel like it was never going to end or we were going to be there infinitely, like –
Sure.
So,
is sequester a dirty word to a jury? You start talking about that?
It would have been really tough. I have four little kids. Mm-hmm. That would have been tough, for sure. And I don't even know what the rules are with that. Like, if they could, wherever we stay, if my kids can come see me. I mean, I don't think they would be okay with me not coming home. That one night I stayed until 9 p.m., one of my five-year-olds, I have twin five-year-olds, but one of them got off the bus and was crying and asking where I was and when I was coming home, and that was the night I wasn't going to come home. So it was tough even just working the five long days a week because I normally only work 3 or 4 days.
Okay. So sequester, that's a word that comes up. And District Attorney Dorley, should future jurors be concerned about that? Is that an appropriate part of the process?
You know, it's up to the discretion of the court whether or not they would sequester a jury. And usually judges, if they have ideas to sequester them, they bring it up early on in the jury selection process. But it wasn't too long ago where we sequestered juries all the time. And after deliberations for the day, you would get in a bus and you would go to a local hotel and you would each have your own hotel room and you weren't able to call your family. And there was actually a deputy sheriff who would be stationed in the hallway so that you couldn't have communication and you couldn't, you know, speak to other jurors. So that has gone by the wayside. Not even on murders, really, anymore did we sequester. But it used to be the norm.
Should it be the norm, Mark Foti?
I can see where there's a potential benefit because you eliminate the concern that a juror will go back and talk to other people and family members, go on the internet, and potentially bring that back to their deliberations the next day. I certainly think that that's something all attorneys fear could potentially happen, and because we don't have a microphone in the room, in most cases, we'll never know whether something like that took place or not. With that said, even though it may be something that used to take place on a regular basis, at this point, it's just not the practice here in Monroe County to do so, and you have cases like the Tom Johnson case, Charles Tan, Don Nguyen. These cases, in each situation, there was an extremely high amount of media coverage. There is certainly the risk of prejudice to the jury if they were to be exposed to any of that. And nonetheless, it was determined that they could go home. So for the most part, it has certainly shifted to a practice that's not going to happen. I could see why there's benefit to it, but you obviously have to balance that with the effect it has on the juror's life. If they are desperate to get a verdict because they want that to come to an end, then that potentially has a negative effect on ultimately the way they deliberate mm-hmm. as well.
All right, let me grab a phone call, and if you want to call the program, 844-295-TALK, toll-free, 844-295-8255. David in Aurora is listening, I presume, on 89.5 FM Finger Lakes Public Radio, WEOS, our sister station there. David, go ahead.
Yes, you're right. I am listening on WEOS. I had two comments. The one is that it's interesting to note that most people, when they come before a jury, they really, assuming they're not guilty, they really want the jury to be competent and listen to the case carefully. And yet, they don't want to serve on the jury themselves, I mean, frequently. And there seems to be a conflict there. The other thing is the film. And I remember seeing this when I was growing up, black and white film, 12 Angry Men. Great film. And they've done it in plays locally. I think they did it at the high school in Lansing. That's just essential in realizing how one holdout person converted the other 11 people to a not guilty verdict when the other 11 were pushing to run this thing through very quickly. And in going over, you know, everything that happened, this happened to do with a child who was up for murder. And in reviewing everything, they had to decide that he was not guilty. And the one person holdout made the difference.
David,
okay, thanks.
David, thank you for the phone call from Aurora. And Gary Craig, history tells us that things can turn around, right? I mean, that is not impossible.
You mean within the jury
sure.
room?
Or,
oh, yes. I mean, there's probably no... Well, I think, if I understand right, there's even perhaps some movement in the case as far as people mm-hmm. considering not guilty and guilty. But yeah, I believe the deliberations, obviously people's minds can be changed. Returning back to something Mark was talking about, it's interesting, and I'm not advocating sequestration here, but it's interesting that as we've moved away from that, jurors probably have more options now to get information than they ever have. I mean, let's face
it,
we're so accustomed to pulling out our phone and looking at things. I think it's even tougher now, I would assume, for jurors to sort of keep that, as the judge admonishes them not to look at any information about this case. But there's more ways to get that information now than ever before.
And that's just a case of jurors behaving ethically, isn't it, Jennifer? I mean, and you've talked about that this hour already, yeah?
Oh, absolutely. Like, my mother-in-law lives with me, and she likes to listen to the news every night. So she would just go up in her room, and they kind of sort of figured out what case I was on, because every time something came on about it, I would leave the room, or I would be like, I have to go to the store, or whatever. Like, so my husband and my mother-in-law sort of kind of figured out which trial I was on without me even saying anything. So then they tried to be a lot more discreet about listening to the news accounts of it, and we also get the newspaper. I think we're still, there's not as many people these days that get the newspaper delivered to their home, but we get it on the weekends. And so my mother-in-law would, she would, take those articles away out of my sight, which was a good idea. So definitely it was everywhere. But I didn't really notice that it was everywhere because I listened to what the judge said. He said, don't look it up online and don't go on Facebook and don't use social media. And I can't say I completely avoided Facebook for that 3-week period, but I was very limited in my contact with it, and it didn't really present a problem for me.
Good for you. And I know that should offer some confidence that the juries are following judges' instructions. I think that's great. And let me also just say, because Gary Craig is done great work for years, I will say, Gary doesn't have to say it, you really ought to be subscribing and reading his work on a daily basis. That's what I think. But Gary...
Well, I won't argue with that, so thank you.
But Gary also points out you weren't the only one covering the trial. John Hand and Veronica Volk for us did such a great job. This was a trial that captured our community's attention. We're talking not only about the result of the Tan trial and what went on inside the jury room, but more broadly about juries. And in a moment, we're going to get a short break in here, and we're going to come back and talk about stress for juries, what Jennifer and her fellow jurors went through, and what D.A. Dorley and others are doing to kind of research that and make sure juries do feel comfortable, because it's never going to be an easy process when you're considering a murder charge. But one of our listeners, Jake, writes to the program and says, doesn't surprise me too much the jury couldn't be unanimous. Why wasn't a lesser charge on the table? Again, the D.A. can't comment on that right now. Jennifer, as a juror, would that have changed anything, do you think?
We actually did talk about it in the jury room, that if manslaughter had been presented as an option, that we probably would have convicted very early.
Well, can I raise another issue about the case?
Sure.
Which perhaps others here can't. I would, if you'd been able to consider him an accomplice, would...
That was another point that we heard little tidbits about during the case. None of us really knew by law what that meant, but we definitely think he had involvement in the crime, so that would have helped as well.
Yes.
Okay. Well, see, I really ought to let you interrogate Jennifer for the rest of the day. Gary was in that courtroom just about every day, the day of the trial.
Actually, so. John Hand was there for us all the time.
There you go. Yes. Let's get a short break in, and once again, if you're just joining us, we'll get back to your phone calls. We're talking about what to expect if you're on a jury and how to make sure juries are given the space and the comfort to do their difficult work. We're talking to Sandra Dorley, the Monroe County District Attorney. Jennifer McGough is here, one of the jurors in the recent TAN trial. Gary Craig, a reporter with the Democrat and Chronicle, and Mark Foti, chair of the Monroe County Bar Association Criminal Justice Section and a former public defender. Short break and much more connections next. Coming up in our second hour, one of the few survivors of a suicide attempt off the Golden Gate Bridge in San Francisco is Kevin Hines. He's in Rochester today. He's become an advocate for mental health and suicide prevention. His remarkable story of falling 220 feet into the bay, 80 feet deep into the water, and surviving, and what he's doing now. That's next hour on Connections.
Working at Napa State Hospital in California can be dangerous.
Violence is part of the daily life at Napa.
The facility is a state psychiatric hospital.
Our staff are serving incredibly ill, complicated patients that have criminal histories.
Balancing safety with treatment later on All Things Considered from NPR News.
This afternoon at 4 on WXXI.
Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Here's another headline from the Democrat and Chronicle written by Dave Andriotta. Stress mounted for TAN trial jurors. And in a moment, we're going to get more into exactly what that means. But I imagine part of that, Jennifer, has just to be you are making a very important decision, but you've got to be learning as much as you can in a short amount of time about a law that you knew nothing about going in, right?
We didn't know anything until after the trial was completed and the summations had been completed, and then finally that was when the judge read the law to us. It took about 40 or 45 minutes for him to read that law.
Would you flip that? Would you change that in any way? Are you comfortable with that setup?
I haven't really considered that at all. I don't know. I think it was okay the way it was.
Okay.
Because you're not, at that point, you're not supposed to have any opinion still. When he reads the law to you, you're not to have an opinion until of what you would vote in the jury room until you've heard all the evidence, then you hear the summations, then you hear the law read to you, then you deliberate, then you can make a decision.
Okay. That's generally a fair way to frame it.
Exactly. Can I ask her a question?
Yeah, this is, of course.
Once upon a time, there was a judge who actually used a PowerPoint, and the jury instructions were on a screen in the courtroom. I've always been curious. I mean, we're so familiar with the law, but for jurors, would it be better if you could read along as the judge read it to you?
Yes, we requested that, and that request was not met. We asked for the law written. We wanted to bring that into the jury room.
That would drive me crazy. If I run a jury, I'd want to see it in writing.
Yeah.
I'd want to be able to.
We wanted a lot of things in writing. We wanted the ability to take notes during the trial, and that was very early on ruled we were not going to be able to take notes. And 7 days of evidence was presented. You're not going to remember everything. And then everybody goes in the jury room, and they remember things differently. And, like, I didn't even know. We didn't know their names. We forgot. Oh, who was that? Who was that? I don't even remember. The only thing we ever got in writing that we requested was a list of the people that had testified. And they did comply with that and give us a list of the people. And then when we got the list, we were like, who's this? Who's that? I don't remember. So being able to take notes would have been huge. And so that's why we ended up listening to so much testimony read back, because I was like, we saw the name. I thought I remembered who it was. It wasn't the same person that I thought it was. So then we would have to listen to the testimony, go back to the jury room, and then we would all keep our mouths quiet as we wrote down everything that person said, and then we would go back out and listen to the next person.
All right, Sandra and Mark, and we've got a lot of ground to cover in our last 15 minutes here, but should that part of it change from taking notes to seeing things written? Should that change, District Attorney Dorley?
Well, some judges have in the past allowed note-taking, but they want you to be able to concentrate on, you know, the affect of the witness, how the witness delivers a testimony, and to make eye contact. Some people get, you know, caught up in taking
head
the accurate
down,
notes.
Taking notes, yeah.
Right. And you have a court reporter who takes the official record, so anything can be read back. So, you know, judges are shying away from giving permission to take notes.
But how about seeing the written law?
I would be a proponent for that. Going back I remember the judge that did that. Jurors were comfortable, you know, looking at the law as it's being read to them. And I think people are moving towards being visual, more visual. And I think if they saw it, they could understand it, comprehend it, and perhaps.
Can I make a request? Would be the way that the readbacks are done. I would recommend changing. Can we not just either videotape or like audio record the people that testify and then listen to it back? Because when the court reporter reads it back, she reads it at lightning speed. You don't know you don't know what the tone of their voice was. It was not that helpful.
So you go for, in the live trial, no notes because you want to lock in and make eye contact and get the full affectation, to, in the readbacks, monotone lightning speed with nothing.
Absolutely.
And that's frustrating for you as a juror.
It was, because sometimes the way that people say, and even like we were dissecting things down, I think, more than maybe we should have, and overthinking them in a way. But even the way that people testified, things that Charlie Tan said, that was up to debate. Well, how did he say it? Did he pause? Mm-hmm. Was it all one complete phrase? Did he say it one boom, boom, boom? Or did he, like, pause? Was there a question in between? Like, so that was, I mean, even that was up for debate.
All right, Mark Foti, should they get things in writing?
I think it tends to depend from jurisdiction to jurisdiction and case to case. Certainly if they're requesting the instructions and they want to review it, I personally think that it only serves to the advantage of the deliberation process if they receive a copy of it. I think that particularly in cases where the instructions are a bit more complicated, and it definitely does vary from case to case, it makes sense for them to be able to review it in person. I think one of the issues as far as recordings, which was just brought up, and Gary probably is able to speak to this, it's actually illegal because of the New York State Civil Rights Law, Section 50 through 52. You can't record witnesses, and the idea behind that is because there's fear that the witness would potentially be intimidated as a result of having it recorded. So they have to steer away from that and sort of rely on the transcripts and having the court reporter read it off as opposed to a recording itself.
But they're being recorded. Every word they say is being written down. So how is it different if we listen to it?
That's true. That's a good point.
Maybe not a video, but an audio would even be more helpful.
So, somehow states across the country have managed to do this without problems, but in New York we can't quite do it.
Doesn't surprise me.
Gary and I are going to be on the same side on this one. Yeah, and Gary and I and many others, Sean Carroll and many others, have talked about wanting to see New York courts as open and as accessible as possible. I understand Mark Foti's point. You don't want witnesses to feel fear, but I think just simply talking to them, saying, you're being recorded, like Jennifer just mentioned, it's being recorded, it's being transcribed, it's part of a process.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I think that I agree with Gary. They've done it elsewhere. I want to work through a couple phone calls, and Robert in Chilai wants to call in and commend Jennifer for her work as a juror. Go ahead, Robert.
I think that Jennifer's comments about what it means to be on a jury and what the responsibilities of a juror are should be read to every prospective juror. I commend her attitude. Wonderful. A good example of what citizenship means.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Robert. Thanks for the phone call. And I think everyone on this panel feels the same way, that it's such a great attitude and very refreshing to hear someone who's this thorough and committed to the process. To the Mike and Irondequoit next up. Go ahead, Mike.
Oh, good afternoon. Pardon me. Good afternoon. It's a fascinating, fascinating show, as usual.
Well, thank you, sir.
The thing I'd like to see happen is to take the British approach, where there's no discussion until the trial is over. Nothing in the newspapers, nothing on television. This makes life a whole lot easier on everybody. Let the facts come out at the trial, not in the newspapers, not on television. And people seem to get an awful lot of exercise jumping to conclusions based on incomplete narratives, and that would put an end to all this. My two cents worth. thanks for a great show.
Mike, thanks. You're usually right on the money. Today, Gary Craig.
Well, or we could back it up to the moment of crime and not report it from there either. I mean, where do you stop that?
Now, Gary and I are going to be a little snarky about this, but Mike is very well intended here.
Oh, I agree. No, I agree.
No question about it.
If I sound sarcastic, my apologies.
No, it's okay. But what's the brief substantive answer?
Well, for one, I think. As we see here, the jury system has, you know, the people are following the admonitions of the judge. They are not following the media. They're not looking at the media. Does the media somehow perhaps sort of, you know, shape the way the public opinion is going at the time? I won't deny that. But, you know, we're a country that's pretty much had a free press from not day one, but early on. And I don't want to talk slippery slope because then you get into a whole different issue. But I just worry about the idea that we're going to sort of, basically handcuff and you know, sort of muzzle the media during a trial until the end.
I want to talk a little bit about stress first inside the jury room and then what our district attorney thinks about it and what research tells us about it. So first of all, Jennifer McGough, who was one of the jurors in the Tan trial, you know, again, everyone's commending you for the level head that you have for this, but personally, how much stress was this for you?
It wasn't like a kind of stress that you consciously knew at the time. It manifested more in a way where I would lay down to go to bed at night and I would see the photographs going through my head and I wouldn't sleep and I would have dreams of the case. I would have dreams of people coming into my dreams that asking me, did he do it? Did he do it? That kind of stuff. So I wasn't sleeping well. I kind of go back and forth with that at baseline anyway, like I have issues sleeping, so this just made that a little bit worse. And then I just kind of, it consumed me in a way that I thought about it all the time. So even though I was laughing and playing with my kids or doing homework with them or making dinner or whatever, I just never stopped thinking about it. And still, weeks later, I'm still talking about it and thinking about it all the time. So I think that, and that's how I deal with things. So I'm kind of an open book and I talk about everything. Nothing's really private with me, so it was hard. I mean, it was hard because you do have to keep it in. And so the way I normally handle things is to talk to everybody about it. And I couldn't talk to anybody about it.
Absolutely.
So I'm making up for that now.
What kind of stress did you, either in discussion or just noticing your fellow jurors, what kind of stress did you feel in that room?
A lot of us weren't sleeping. We talked about that every day. People were getting bags under their eyes coming in. It makes it, you just, I think, take for granted that this stuff happens on a daily basis and you don't really realize that it happens until you're part of it. And it was not supposed to weigh into your feeling on the verdict what the sentencing would be, but you knew that the defendant in this case was probably, if he did it, allegedly, that he was driven to it over years of horrible things that he'd witnessed or been firsthand part of, and that he did it because he thought there was no other solution. And that's what was very tragic about it and hard to handle, because you don't want him to necessarily spend the rest of his life in prison. You don't think he's a bad kid and that he's probably never going to commit another crime, and he could go on and make some great cure for cancer, or he's a bright guy and has tons of potential. So that was tough. That was really stressful.
Now, again, from the Democrat and Chronicle, David Andriotta, writing about stress that juries feel, a couple of points here. Studies have shown jurors to exhibit psychological and physical symptoms, including insomnia, as we just heard, mm-hmm. anxiety, stomach aches, depression, even after the conclusion of their trial. So not just during, but after, and Jennifer's talking about that now. Symptoms are often more pronounced in cases that feature graphic or violent evidence, and that's easy to understand why there. And also from the DNC, more than two-thirds of jurors report feeling some stress as a result of jury duty. And some research, including some from California, finds that 11% of jurors exhibit symptoms consistent with PTSD. District Attorney Sandra Dorley, what does that say to you? I mean, do you accept some of that? I mean, is that a concern?
That's spot on. I've studied the research. You know, we started seeing it with grand jurors as well. We had one particular grand jury that over a four-week term heard 12 homicide presentations and several child abuse presentations. And, you know, we spoke to them afterwards. And, you know, We ended up setting up or giving them a brochure that these were the resources that were available to them. But we've also, I've had jurors call in from other murder trials and just explain, you know, their feelings or insomnia and all of the symptoms that you've just mentioned. It seems that we really need to do a better job in dealing with that and providing some help to jurors. You know, what are our obligations? You know, it's still under consideration, but they're at the very least, there needs to be a good debriefing where they can, you know, talk about how they feel as we're doing here, and especially after they render a verdict.
And so going forward, whether it's ongoing research, what do you think is either happening now or can happen to help figure out exactly what could be done?
You know, we in Monroe County, we need to have a support system set up so that after your service is completed, that we can hook you up with services so you can talk about it and help alleviate the stress, because PTSD is something real.
Okay. Mark Foti, what do you think about jury stress and what could be done about that? I mean, to some degree, you can't eliminate all stress. We're talking about deliberating over some really, really tough crimes. So that's going to be part of the process. But what do you see as a possibility to make things a little bit lighter or more manageable for jurors?
Well, I think it's hard to answer the question because there's different factors that obviously contribute to the stress. One is obviously the process of debating nonstop for multiple days, potentially. One is the graphic nature of some of these cases. One, I think, is potentially the guilt that certain people feel when they actually arrive to a verdict and they're not 100% sure that that was the verdict that was appropriate. If there's, we talked earlier about people holding out, and if that person is to concede one way or another and turn to a guilty verdict or vice versa, you can imagine that's something they'll carry with them for a long time. A good example is a documentary about Central Park Five, the five young individuals mm-hmm. who were ultimately exonerated. And one of the jurors was interviewed during that documentary, and he becomes extremely animated when he talks about the deliberation process because he was one of the only holdouts. And it's obviously something that stuck with him the entire process all these years later, that he ended up becoming exhausted and conceding to the majority. And that's something that obviously could have a dramatic effect on individuals regardless of which direction they went, if they are to concede potentially their values because everybody else is pushing them to do so. That can be a factor as well. So trying to come up with a solution is obviously difficult because you have to identify those individual issues and determine what the appropriate response is to multiple potential factors.
Let me sneak in one quick phone call. This is Elizabeth in Mendon, has been waiting. Go ahead, Elizabeth.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I had a question, really, I guess, for Sandra Dorley. Given that there was a mistrial, how do you find a jury for a retrial?
Thanks for the phone call, Elizabeth. Go ahead, District Attorney Dorley.
That's a really good question. But believe it or not, I believe there are probably people in this community who will be called for jury service the next time who are not familiar with this case.
Go ahead, Gary. It seems impossible, but there are.
But believe it or not, yeah.
I'll be quick, but I can tell you there's nothing more humbling, and this has happened to me multiple times, to have written about a criminal case for months, if not longer, to sit in the voir dire, prospective jurors there, and to watch them ask, "Do you know anything about this crime?" And like everybody shakes their head, "No."
Trust me. I just prosecuted Thomas Johnson III for the murder of Daryl Pearson, Officer Daryl Pearson, and I assumed that everyone in this community knew about it. And I remember the jury panel coming in, and the judge asked, "You know, who's familiar with this case?" And very few people raised their hand. So I'm optimistic that we can ultimately find a new jury who can be fair and impartial.
We're not going to get through all the audience comments. We're just flooded. There's so much interest in the subject, which means we need to keep talking about juries. I mean, there's a lot of interest. But RW says, why not nullify? Couldn't the jury have the power to tell the judge that no matter what happened, the defendant was justified in his actions and nullify the charges? When you hear a comment like that, Sandra, I mean, that's not what the jury's being asked to do, right?
Right,
Mark Foti,
right.
Are you giving a thumbs up to that? What are you saying, Mark?
No, you weren't supposed to call me out on that.
My back was turned.
I didn't see a thing. Brief comment, Mark. What do you say to that?
The obviously the official answer is no. Nullification is not allowed in any respect. I think I'm kind of just gave a thumbs up because it's a concept that attorneys find extremely fascinating. They are not told by the judge that they consider the mitigating circumstances or the sympathetic circumstances.
Or the victim in this case might have been somebody who you didn't like the way they behaved or he was abusive.
Right. I mean, this might have been
not part of the consideration.
This may have been the ideal case for nullification if it was something that they could consider, but the judge never talks about that and specifically limits the jury to the facts of the case. So it's more just a personal interest and an interest any attorney who tries cases has as to what happens again in that room that we can't be a part of. But I didn't intend to get called out on the thumbs up.
No. I know you weren't endorsing nullification. But I think Mark's right here. I mean, in this case, if it's ever going to happen, it might happen in a case like this. That is not part of the process. And jurors like Jennifer McGough have reminded us that if we get cynical about the process, they are taking it very seriously.
Mm-hmm.
And Jennifer, thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Boy, thank you for the work that you and the jury did on this. I know it wasn't easy.
Not at all. Thank you.
A lot to learn and a lot to keep talking about going forward. Jennifer, thank you. Gary Craig from the Democrat and Chronicle. Mark Foti, thank you, Mark. And District Attorney Sandra Dorley. Thank you, Sandra. I appreciate your time as well.
Thank you.
All right, short break. We are talking to one of only 34 people who's ever jumped off the Golden Gate Bridge and survived. And he's a suicide prevention advocate. He's in Rochester. That's next.